From KCRW, these are the Legal Eagle Files.
Hi, Jessica Levinson.
Hi, Madeline Brand. Welcome to our second episode of the Legal Eagle Files.
I know, I'm excited. I'm excited to talk to you because today we're going to really get into an issue, a couple of issues that I think are particularly important to us, and that is abortion rights and what's been happening during coronavirus with certain states saying we're going to take a pause on providing abortions because they're not deemed an essential service. So we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court arguments over a key abortion decision. We're going to talk about the future of abortion rights. A lot of that, I think, is of interest to our listeners and, of course, to us because, well, we like to talk about these legal issues. And we're going to talk about what it's like to be at home as a working mom, which we both are.
Madeline, we're in somewhat different positions in that I have a young child at home and you have a teen and adult at home. So what is it
like
for you?
Well, they're both teens.
Oh, that's right.
One technically an adult.
What is it like working full-time, having two almost adult children in the house?
Well, emphasis on the almost, because they're nowhere near being adults. Let's be honest. It takes a long time to cook a child. It seems to take longer these days than it did in the past. Maybe until the 30s or 40s, who knows? But anyway, any thought that I had that I would be living with people who would take on adult responsibilities inside the home voluntarily, that's out the window. So basically, I think I have two overgrown toddlers in my house who blessedly sleep till noon or past noon. So there's that, unlike your situation where I bet your kid, who's what, 4 years old? She probably wakes up at the crack of dawn, like before the birds are even singing.
So I do, as you mentioned, have a not quite a little older than toddler at home. She actually has transitioned to more of a college sleep pattern. So we let her stay up not exactly until Saturday Night Live hours, but a little too late. And then she wakes up, you know, perhaps a little late for a four-year-old, which is why we, frankly, are taping a little later today than we otherwise would have. But yes, look, it's been interesting. We're very, very lucky in the sense that my husband and I both have jobs where we can work from home. We're very lucky in the sense that we can trade off. But we're dealing with what a lot of people are dealing with, which is struggling to be semi-productive professionals. We're both lawyers, struggling to be, you know, semi-competent parents, and making sure that our daughter is happy, that we don't have in moments where, you know, she really falls apart and realizes she's not going to go back to school or see her friends for quite a long time. And, it, you know, somebody posted, it's so true, there's no better way to feel like a terrible professional and a terrible parent than to be working from home and full-time and being a full-time parent.
Yeah, I know. I remember asking my mom about that because she was a working mom. She was a doctor. And for a large portion of that time was a single mom raising two girls. And I asked her how she felt about that. And she said, you know, quite candidly and self-disparagingly, that she didn't think she did either job well. Well, which I think is something that women feel a lot. Like they don't feel like they're doing anything well or they're doing anything as well as they could if they're doing all these things, which is a little bit of a bummer.
Well, goes back to pre-COVID times, which is you're never in the right place in the sense that whenever I'm working, I could be parenting, and whenever I'm parenting, I could be working. And that's incredibly fortunate in the sense that I have a job that I love. I have a child that I love, but you're always torn. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, when everything is compacted, literally physically compacted, so that your child and your work are in the same place, it really brings that to the forefront. I mean, I think that I've seen a lot of social media posts about the people, you know, the moms who have the color-coded schedules for the four-year-olds, and, you know, here's academic time, and we kind of had to throw that out the window. I think I mentioned this to you before. One of my greatest parenting wins is to try and get our daughter interested in the type of music I like. And because I'm actually a 70 to 80 year old at heart, she has now really taken to Rosemary Clooney tunes.
Wow, that is an achievement of some sort.
And this is a big win for us during the quarantine. Maybe our biggest win is that she will walk into the room and politely, because we're working on please, ask for Mambo Italiano or her favorite, Gee, I Wish I Was Back in the Army, which you don't want to describe in too much detail to a four-year-old, because who really wants to get into, now let's talk about war, while we're, you know, basically just trying to keep her happy and not use the words global pandemic too often.
Yeah, while we're actually kind of in a war, to be honest. I applaud you. I think that's...
You can't talk to her. I do not... We're not doing FaceTime with Madeline right now. Even though she does miss you and she does talk about you, I don't want that cold, hard truth of, well, we are in a pandemic, so let's talk about what that means.
Well, hopefully she doesn't know what that word actually means. It's a big word. That's a $3 word. I remember when my kids were that age and tried to get them interested in what we were interested in. And at that point, we were watching a lot of Roman Polanski movies. And so...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. They were a little too young to be watching Rosemary's Baby. But anyway, it was a Thanksgiving tradition. Now you have a little window into our household. So...
They both became delightful teenagers. I've met them.
Delightful slumbering teenagers. Okay, so we are going to talk about abortion. This is a serious topic because I don't think I could have foreseen this level of action, quick action, when it came to denying women their right to abortion during COVID times. So, Jessica, how many states have gone ahead and said, look, abortion is not an essential medical service, and denied women that right to get an abortion?
Yeah, it looks like it's about a dozen states where they have said they've basically, from my perspective, frankly, used COVID as cover to try and do what they've wanted to do for a long time, which is restrict access to abortion or ban it completely. So what we're talking about here is a couple of red states where it's not the legislature necessarily that acted, but it's actually governors by executive action said, it's COVID, we're in a global pandemic, we have to shut down all non-essential medical procedures. And one of those non-essential medical procedures is an abortion. Now, I think the pretty quick response to that is abortion, unlike other medical procedures, is a constitutional right. It's a due process right. And it's something that's time limited.
Yeah.
So if you are forced to delay your abortion, you actually may be forced into a space where it then becomes illegal under the regular state laws to obtain that abortion. So for a host of reasons, I think abortion really is different, but it was fascinating to see this kind of wave of red states trying in varying degrees of success to restrict for at least, you know, a period of time, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, access to abortion.
Well, I guess I'm not understanding the explanation that this is a non-essential service and you could just wait it out. I mean, everyone knows there's a time limit to this.
Yeah, everybody knows it's a time limit. I mean, the main explanation was, we can't overcrowd our hospitals, we can't use up too much personal protection equipment, and therefore we have to restrict all non-essential medical procedures. And, you know, as we talked about, the answer to that's pretty quick. One, about 50% of abortions in this country, I understand, are actually the medically induced abortions where you take two pills, so you're not undergoing a surgery. So you wouldn't have the worries about overcrowding the hospital or using personal protective equipment.
Right. And those were also banned because those fell under the rubric of abortions, even though they weren't taking place in hospitals or clinics.
Right. For a lot of the states that we're talking about, it was all abortions, period. And what courts really realized in looking at this is that it didn't make a lot of sense. And actually, if you're worried about overcrowding medical offices or hospitals, then it doesn't make sense to force women to carry pregnancy to term, because I think you have an average of about 11 visits to a gynecologist or another medical professional during your pregnancy. Then, of course, you have to stay in the hospital when you actually have a child.
Well, that brings up the other point, Jessica, and that is most abortions don't take place in hospitals. They take place elsewhere. So it's not even a matter of freeing up hospital beds, because they take place in clinics that wouldn't see COVID patients.
Exactly. So the vast, vast majority of abortions are not in a hospital. The vast, vast majority of abortions, you would never need to go to a hospital. It's actually one of the safest procedures. And, you know, as we talked about on Press Play, it's safer than actually carrying a child to term. That's in no way meant as an advertisement. It's just meant as a scientific fact that if you're looking to protect people's health, if you're looking to try and make sure that you're not overwhelming the hospital system, that you are not using too much personal protective equipment, none of those problems are solved by banning abortion. And that's what a lot of courts recognized.
So out of those dozen states, how many of them were allowed to continue to do that versus saying, you know, the court saying, no, that's just not reasonable activity?
Yeah, so here's where I'm going to kind of punt for a little bit and we can decide what to do. But so these laws were challenged almost immediately in district courts throughout the country. And then Court of Appeals have been ruling on them really every day. And so by the time people listen, this might have actually changed. But in terms of the laws that are not in effect anymore, these bans that states tried and they've lost, we're looking at Alabama, Ohio, Tennessee, Iowa, Texas. For a variety of different reasons, those bans are not in effect. If you look at other states like Arkansas or Oklahoma or Louisiana, there are still bans in that are being implemented, but it's a very, very fluid situation. So I'm trying to be careful to give definitive numbers.
Well, let's talk about Texas, because Texas all of a sudden said, never mind, abortions are allowed. What was their explanation for that?
Yeah, Texas had this really weird kind of up and back where first Texas said we're banning all abortions. And then there was a lot of legal wrangling. It kind of went up and down with the district court and the Fifth Circuit. And it looked like the Fifth Circuit was actually amenable to part of the ban. And then Texas just kind of pulled back and said, you know what? That's okay. We're not going to implement this ban anymore. I think in part because if you kept the ban in place, it was going to have to go up to the Supreme Court. And I'm not sure that Texas or other red states, frankly, wanted that language from the Supreme Court, because it's pretty clear if you look at the current standard, which I know we're going to get to in a minute, that this is an undue burden on a woman's right to obtain an abortion. And there's no countervailing state interest, as we just talked about. There's no real state interest that is served. This is, frankly, just cover for trying to reduce abortions.
Were they also afraid that this would go to the Supreme Court and the court would have to rule against them, and they didn't want to risk that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that Texas did not want a loss. I think they didn't want the language where the court was going to have to say something like, hey, you know, in our case that actually controls, which isn't Roe versus Wade, it's a case called Casey versus Planned Parenthood. There's no carve out there for if we're in a global pandemic. So you, Texas, have to follow the law. I think Texas ultimately just decided it probably wasn't worth it to get that adverse ruling.
Well, speaking of Texas, this is a good segue, actually. let's talk about a case the Supreme Court heard this term before all this madness happened. And this was a case out of Louisiana, an abortion case, and it really was so similar to a previous case they had already ruled on out of Texas about whether or not doctors should have admitting privileges, abortion providers should have admitting privileges to hospitals, whether they should, their clinics should be ambulatory care centers, in a sense, like have hallways large enough for gurneys and things like that. And the court said, no, there's undue burden on the women, and they struck down the law. Okay, so that was that. So then cut to, 4 years later, now in 2020, and they're seeing, and they're hearing the exact same case all over again, but in Louisiana. Why?
Yeah, it does feel like it's the same case. So the short answer to that is that, that the court in Louisiana, actually, that the circuit upheld this law, even though it looks and walks and talks like a law that's almost exactly identical to the law that was struck down in Texas. And so the Supreme Court has to step in a sense, and say, hey, we just ruled on that, and you're going against Supreme Court precedent. But typically what they would do is they could just do that in a one sentence. They could basically say, see our decision in Whole Woman's Health in 2016, and that would be the end of it. So the idea that the court took the case at all is troubling to many in the pro-choice community, because it may signal that they're open to revisiting that 2016 case. Now, this is, of course, the point where we talk about what's different in the Supreme Court from 2016 to 2020.
And that is the personnel, basically. So we have Kavanaugh on the court now, and we didn't have Kavanaugh on the court before. We have Gorsuch on, and he wasn't on before. Are both of them pretty conservative when it comes to abortion rights?
Yes, but the first personnel shift is the one that really matters. So what's happened from 2016 is Justice Scalia passed away. He was replaced by Justice Neil Gorsuch. That's seen as basically not a game changer, in the sense that they're likely to vote the same way when it comes to abortion restrictions. Now, the one that really matters for this case is Justice Kennedy retiring and being replaced by his former law clerk, now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And so it was Justice Kennedy who, in the 2016 Texas case, joined with the liberals. And he was, in that way, the deciding vote. And he was the one who said, you know, I'm going to leave my typically conservative home, and I'm going to vote to say that this Texas law is an undue burden. And so times have really changed in these 4 years on the court. Now, who do we have as the potential swing vote? It's Chief Justice John Roberts, who in the Texas case would have upheld that law. And so what he would need to do is make a decision that, as the Chief Justice of the United States, it's more important to him that the Supreme Court follow its past precedent, that it's more important to him that the Supreme Court follow a case that it just decided, than it is to vote the way, frankly, he would have if this was a matter of first impression, if this was just coming up before him, because it's this issue, it's this doctrine we call stare decisis, which basically means you shouldn't change the law just because the identity of the judge changes. There needs to be some predictability.
But don't they do that all the time? I don't want to say all the time, but it's not unheard of that the court reverses itself. I mean, you have, for example, the very infamous decision Plessy versus Ferguson. So overturned. So I don't see that as something that is completely foreign to the court, right?
It's not foreign to the court, but the fact that we can all pick out a few cases where that happened, you can also think about Citizens United overturned a whole host of decisions. It means that it doesn't happen often. So typically, if a court changes course, and particularly the Supreme Court, they're going to do it in a way so they don't have to quickly and very overtly overrule a case they just decided. It will be that just over time, kind of imperceptibly, the law changes. And we almost don't notice it because it happens so quietly and so slowly. But it is something that federal judges typically take
very seriously this idea that we should respect the judiciary, we should respect judges, because this isn't just about what they like or don't like. They're really just applying the law to the facts. And it's interesting because this week there was a totally unrelated decision dealing with whether or not jury verdicts have to be unanimous in certain criminal cases. And the argument that the justices were having was largely about stare decisis. And a lot of people are looking at the bickering that the justices had and are saying, oh, you know, what can we read this to mean when it comes to the abortion case?
Aha. So that's really interesting. When will we know? I guess in June, right? If we were in a normal world, we would know in June. Is that still going to be the case?
I don't think so. So it could be. If you were asking me a question about when are we going to find out about what the Supreme Court says, then I would say, oh, it's going to be by June 30th. But now we have a really unprecedented Supreme Court schedule where the cases that were supposed to be argued in March and April were pushed off the calendar. We're going to have telephonic meetings for the first time ever in May. I should try and sound slightly less excited, but for me to be able to listen real time will actually be a true thrill. And so everything is being pushed back in the Supreme Court. So typically speaking, yes, the answer is we're going to have a decision by the end of June. In this case, because the court took a bunch of cases off of its calendar and is going to hear oral arguments later in May by telephone, everything's being pushed back and we're not sure when we're going to have a decision. I mean, it could be July, it could be August.
Wait, what does it mean by telephone? That sounds completely old fashioned.
Yes.
They're actually going to get on the phone and hear the various lawyers make their cases?
So I don't know if they're going to get on Zoom audio or if they'll be, there's an answer to this, but I don't know the answer, which is, I don't know if they're going to do this video conference just between the litigants and the justices, but I understand we're going to get an audio recording and we're going to be able to listen live to the audio, but we won't be able to watch it like you can, frankly, in so many other courtrooms throughout the nation, where if you're interested, these are your justices working for you. You can tune in. But that's a whole other episode on what I think is the absurdity of how opaque and mm-hmm. how kind of cloaked in secrecy the Supreme Court is.
Yeah. Well, that just preserves. It's kind of like the Catholic Church, right? When they were doing masses in Latin, it just preserves this power and sense of, you know, all-seeing, all-knowing.
Secrecy and power.
And you little people don't get to be in on these august proceedings.
They're like Oz behind the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I think we should mention about this case is that there's actually an escape hatch for Chief Justice John Roberts, where the way it's kind of been set up, particularly in the press, it's been this issue of, is Chief Justice John Roberts going to follow the decision that he disagreed with, but the court just made 4 years ago? Or is he going to, vote the way he wants to with his conservative ideals and uphold this law that would restrict access to abortion? There's actually another option here for him. And that is to say that the people who brought the case, the physicians, don't have standing to sue. And so the physicians have actually sued on behalf of the women. They're not suing on their own behalf. They're standing in the shoes of the women who would want to obtain abortions. And so this actually came up for the first time in the Supreme Court arguments. It didn't come up in the lower court, but it might be a really route that looks really good to Chief Justice John Roberts, particularly in election year where he doesn't want to have a big abortion decision come out.
So what would happen in that case? He'd basically say, you're not allowed to bring this case, physicians.
Exactly.
But then what would happen? Then the Louisiana law would remain in effect?
Yes. So if the wrong people walked into the federal courthouse doors, meaning the physicians aren't allowed to bring this claim on behalf of the women, then there can be no decision on the merits. I mean, you don't, it really means you don't have the right party in the court. And so it would mean that the law could stay in effect. It would also mean that it would disrupt years of case law where it's been assumed and understood that in this situation, physicians can step in and sue on behalf of women, because there's a bunch of different issues when you want to sue for an abortion, one of which is, you know, by the time the case works its way up to the Supreme Court, you might have either already had the child or already had the abortion. And so there's a time issue. There's also resource issues of trying to find the right women at the right time. There's privacy issues, but it would really upend that area of the law where we understand that doctors can sue on behalf of women.
Well, it doesn't really make sense at all, because in this particular case, it is about the physician's access to hospitals, having the admitting privileges, or having to retool their clinics to make them ambulatory centers. So they are affected by this.
They are, but physicians didn't bring this case on their own behalf, and they don't have the same rights to perform an abortion as women do to obtain an abortion. And I don't know how much in the weeds you want me to get on this, but basically, when you restrict a person's, you know, professional activities, you can be much more restrictive as a state than you can if you restrict an individual, and in this case, a woman's constitutional rights. And so the idea is, if the physicians sue on their own behalf, they may not be as likely to be successful. Now, super, to me, interesting aside, if you read the Roe versus Wade case, that really is largely about physicians' right to perform abortions. It's not as much about the rights of women. And that's because Justice Blackmun, who wrote the opinion, he went home over the summer recess, during the Supreme Court summer recess, talked to a bunch of people at the Mayo Clinic, and crafted the opinion so that it was largely protecting physicians at that point, largely men, and women didn't have the prominent role that they play. As the abortion cases continued, it shifted, and now the concern is much more for a woman's right to obtain access to abortion.
Okay, so I guess we're TBD when we'll find out how they're going to rule on this.
Yes, I would say safe bet that we'll definitely know by October. I don't think there's going to be an October surprise. So this case has already been argued. It was argued in the beginning of March. I think the Supreme Court is going to be pretty excited to make a decision again in its first big abortion case in at least 4 years, and make that well before the election. I think they want to get out of the way. They don't want to be part of the news cycle for the election.
That's interesting, because the court likes to give the impression that it is impervious to the political winds, that it is this kind of institution carved in marble that, you know, they have lifetime tenures that is not politically driven. I think we all know that that's not exactly true. They're human beings, and they definitely have feet of clay. So it's interesting that they make that, what you said is so apparent, that they want to actually make a statement or not make a statement before the election. It seems incredibly, incredibly political of them.
Well, you know, they are political in some way. So if you think about the bruising battle to get Justice Brett Kavanaugh confirmed, that was just a year ago, what you saw the Supreme Court do really last year, or it was a little over a year ago, they actually had a pretty small docket, and they avoided a lot of big controversial cases. So the court kind of gave itself some breathing room. Now, you can't always time those issues, but you didn't see, for instance, what we see this term, which is there's a big abortion case, there are cases dealing with religious freedom, there are cases dealing with gun control, there's cases dealing with President Trump's tax returns and the power of congressional oversight. So this term really is a blockbuster term, and they were pretty quiet after that really highly publicized confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. So yeah, they're human beings. They know about news cycles. Now, I'm not saying they game everything according to that, but I don't think they want to be part of the election. They don't want to be a talking point. Everybody on the Supreme Court wants the respect of the nation and to not be seen, frankly, as, I think, you know, political football.
Mm-hmm. It seems like everything is a political football these days, even whether or not we should stay home or go out and patronize a hair salon. That seems like a political football.
I feel like you said hair salon because you saw how I dyed my own hair at home and you just wanted to bring that up. It's purplish. Let's just say it now.
I dyed my own hair at home too. And I have to say, I'm kind of pleased with the results.
Well, I'm happy for you. And
well, only because I bought the stuff from my hairdresser.
Yeah, I didn't. I wasn't that forward thinking. So what I have is a situation that's passable in dim lighting, but super problematic if you flip the light switch or go outside in sun, which of course you would never do in unseasonably warm temperatures in the spring like we're having now in Los Angeles. But to your point, yes, everything is political, and there's a larger conversation to be had about how long the Supreme Court can really survive the way it's currently structured, mm-hmm. and how long, frankly, it can survive now where, think about this. The current center of the court is Chief Justice John Roberts, who is in no way a moderate. Now, if you're a conservative, you think that's fantastic and you're super excited that the court is so far to the right. But we don't have what we used to have, which is people who might be in the center of a lot of different issues where you couldn't predict exactly how they were going to vote based on whether a Republican or a Democrat nominated them. We used to actually have people who would shift over time. And typically it was they were appointed by a Republican and they would kind of move to the center and then the center left. But it's fascinating to look at the court and see that the liberal wing of the court, I would offer to you, is really the old moderate center. If you look at, you know, the court 40 or 50 years ago, and I'm just not sure, you know, I'm not sure how long the center will hold. Yes, I'm sorry. We couldn't get away from me quoting Yates in a podcast. So we talked about abortion in the time of COVID. We talked about the big abortion case that's coming up before the Supreme Court this term. I think the question is, what's ahead?
Right. So it seems to me that what's ahead is the ever more winnowing of abortion rights. Am I mistaken?
I don't think that you are mistaken. I think the question is whether or not we're going to have a big moment in the near future where the Supreme Court says we're overturning Roe versus Wade, we're overturning Casey versus Planned Parenthood, or what I think is a lot more likely, where in fact what we see is more of a death by a thousand paper cuts approach to a woman's right to obtain an abortion. And so what's coming up is more of these bans where, for instance, you have heartbeat bans. So if you can hear the fetus heartbeat, then you can no longer have an abortion. Or we have bans on abortions for specific purposes, like if the doctor knows that you're having an abortion because the child would have Down syndrome. And question coming up will be, how many of these specific bans will the court say, oh, that's not an undue burden. That's not an undue burden. So that eventually that undue burden standard just doesn't do any work. And you're really left with a hollow constitutional right.
But I think that's the case in so many localities here in the United States. Maybe not here in California so much, but in states all over the country where there are a lot of women. And of course, this falls most heavily on women who do not have money, women who are in stretched, difficult circumstances. that that's effectively the case. They either have to travel miles and miles, they have to get a, you know, a parent's permission, and they don't have a parent they can go to, what have you. There are a million different reasons why it's very difficult for women to get abortions and girls to get abortions these days.
I think it is absolutely the case that when it comes to the question of whether or not a woman can obtain an abortion, the biggest issue isn't what the Supreme Court has said. It's whether or not you live in a state that, I should say, it's whether or not really you live in a blue state or a red state. So, you know, we're talking to you from California, and we have state laws that protect the right for women to obtain an abortion. But if you live in another state, and or if you have issues dealing with the resources to obtain an abortion, you're in a completely different world. And so, yes, these restrictions fall, there's no question about it, most heavily on women who don't have the same level of resources, who would have to get childcare, leave a job, drive far away to obtain an abortion. So it is already the case that it is a huge burden for many people in this country, many women in this country, to obtain an abortion.
Yeah. I think, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but we started the show talking about, oh, the differences in domestic work at home in these circumstances where we're all quarantined. But I feel like we're all looking at all of these issues now a lot differently. We're looking at who's an essential worker, who is most at risk of getting this disease, who is, you know, shouldering most of the burden in these times. And time again, it falls on the shoulders of women, and women who are not at the top of the food pyramid when it comes to wealth or, you know, societal recognition, but women who are, you know, providing the structure to this society at this time are shouldering an undue burden. And I think this whole situation is just ripping the scab off what we knew about intellectually, but now we're really kind of feeling and experiencing.
Yeah, I was part of a discussion where we were talking about the federal relief package. And what came to the fore in this discussion was the idea that we had this system of gross inequality. And I think most people knew about this, but the pandemic really was like a stress test on the system. And it showed that the house could not survive an earthquake, essentially. And so when the walls fell down, what you saw is a system of, yes, gross inequality, but women, and particularly women of color, who are now deemed to be essential workers for a variety of reasons, shouldering a huge portion of the burden. And it does, I mean, these types of horrible moments do tend to show the festering wounds that we have below the surface. And, you know, there's kind of no denying who's providing us with our food, our healthcare, our medical care, you know, caring for elderly, caring for children. I mean, this is largely, we're sending out women and women of color into the world when the rest of us are being told to shelter in place.
Mm. Yeah. Right. And then if they need to get an abortion, well, you know, good luck.
Well, and of course, the irony of states saying we need to shelter in place and you should not travel, and then telling women you can't have an abortion in this state, therefore forcing them to travel if they want to get an abortion much further and really risking their health, is not lost on many people. So, okay, I'm going to ask the same question I asked last week. How do we not end on that note?
Well, we do end on that note, I guess, because that's kind of the note that we're all playing at this moment. Kind of a where do we go note. I mean, I will say, we should end on a more positive note, as we did last time. And that is, when we get to these moments in our history where we're faced with a crisis, we do have a stark choice. And maybe it wasn't so stark a month ago, but it is now, in terms of where we want to go, how we want to refigure society and our priorities. And I, for one, am pretty hopeful that a lot of us will push for something better. That when we emerge from all of this, it won't be just, oh, same old, same old. That, yeah, there's going to be a lot of pain. A lot of people will have lost their jobs, and it'll be difficult for a long time. But I think in the long run, I think the country will be better, because I think we will have seen what we saw and we won't want to go back to that.
I think that's perfect. I don't think anybody wants me to pour cold water on that ending. So I will say all of these issues give us a lot to talk about. I know we have forthcoming episodes planned on your right to vote during a global pandemic, on your workers' rights during global pandemic, what your employer can say, what the state can say. And so there'll be a lot more to come before we emerge and hopefully get to your, you know, city on a hill ideal, which I will happily follow you to any day of the week.
Thank you.
So because I said any day of the week, and we started this by saying happy Saturday, and then you said, although this we weren't taping, it really could be any day. There's that famous book, Alexander and the No Good, Terrible, Very Bad Day. And so this has been going around. It's Alexander and the day that blended into every other day like some Kafkaesque nightmare with no merciful end in sight.
You did manage to bring it down.
I thought that was our shtick here.
The dark muck of despair.
My microphone is also being propped up on a book by Kafka. So, okay,
so
I feel like
Kafka
we have to
can
go there.
Uplift.
Done. Scene. Retire. We're never going to do better than that.
All right. See you next week.
Goodbye.